It's great to be a nerd. It's great to be a nerd. The only light we ever see is from our monitor.
They argue about comic books and internet connections. The biggest highlight of the year is the Star Trek convention.
Our turn wasn't big enough to sign up any stars. But we much better Richard, who was phased by a Borg.
Ben,
he knew Mr. Sulu.
What?
It's great to be a nerd. It's great to be a nerd.
Good day and welcome to Nerdcast episode 30. So this is one of those great milestones in the Nerdcast episode road, or whatever you want to call it, 30. So we are now officially 3 decades into the Nerdcast, if you want to count, if you want to count that way. It depends on how you count. But yeah, so today it's actually going to be maybe... Like, if you look at the amount of people that we have on the Nerdcast today, it might be a little bit quieter than normal, but I think we might be able to make up for the normal chit-chat. So today we have myself, because David Redekop is actually in another meeting, but Dennis Hausnick from West Virginia was able to join us for Nerdcast episode 30. So welcome, Dennis.
Well, it's great to be here, Arthur. We should mention you're just back from your trip to Mexico. Brushed up on your Spanish a little bit, I presume?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I learned about 50% more Spanish than I knew. So, it's not very much, actually. Yeah, so that was great. Okay, so as we normally do, we start out with good news just because we love positive stuff, and positive stuff is just the best, right? So... we're going to start with Dennis and see what he has for some good news, some stuff to brighten up our lives today.
Well, I have to. My good news is diffuse. Lots of little things. Nothing earth shaking. I met another neighbor yesterday or the day before because he saw the Nerdmobile parked out front of my house and stopped by and said, "Oh yeah, I've got a laptop. I think I've got a virus infection and." You know, it's I've lived in the same neighborhood for quite a few years, but there are always people who come and go, and it's always good to meet new neighbors just by having a red car parked out in front of your house with a lot of decals on it. Along the lines of the data center, we've got some things moving along to improve the performance of some of the sites that have been a little bit. Of an issue. One of the great things about the data centers, every week, I start out on Monday morning, I'll take about 5 minutes and I'll jot down my goals for the week and what I hope to get accomplished. And then on Friday, I look at that and I'm always very sad that I've fallen so far short of all the things that I wanted to get done. Part of that's because a lot of things pop up that I don't know about. Mm-hmm. But one of the great things is that every week when stuff comes up, we just have such a great team. I mean, an issue comes up, and pretty soon you've got Alex in Atlanta, and you've got Mark in Ontario, and you've got Francois in South Africa, and you've got David in the UK, and you got Jeff in Ontario, and people come together and solve problems. And I'm just always amazed at the quality of the team. Mm-hmm. That does that. And along the lines of the remote nerd team and the security team, we're kind of pulling things together a little bit. We're going to start a pilot project this Saturday, installing some security software with one of Chris Polis's clients. And I think we're moving really toward maturing, offering nerd care for nerds through the remote nerd team so that we can really, put together some good quality managed services that we can offer out to members of the team and really build on and mature our team model as mm-hmm. far as nerd care. Chris is piloting some great things where every nerd care proposal that he does is going to have both bios and photos of of his support team, because he has a dedicated support team for all of his nerd care clients. I think that's a really good move toward a model of really strengthening the team model for nerd care. Mm-hmm. So those are all little bits of good news of things that are moving forward, just like we eat an elephant, one bite at a time. You know, it's frustrating sometimes that things don't move along as quickly as I'd like. But when I sit back at the end of the week and take a look, I'd see that there was progress each and every week.
Good stuff, Dennis. And just imagine what would happen if you did eat an elephant all at one time. It would not be a pretty sight. So, you know, it's actually probably a good thing that it happens slowly. It's kind of like eating very quickly. It's just not good for you. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe that's not the right analogy, but it's good. Okay. All right. Well, myself, as some of you might know, I wasn't here last week. And the reason was actually happened to go to Mexico for a mission trip. And I'll actually just show a map of the place where I went to on the screen here. So it's actually, the area was in Huayapan, and it's close to the Gulf of Mexico, and went up about 2-3 hours into the mountains, and worked with a couple different churches there when with the native people. And so probably in about this area right here where you see my mouse kind of floating around. And yeah, it was good. There's two places, little villages. There's Loma del Tigre, which is translated Hill of the Tiger. And so actually they used to have tigers in that area at one time, but not anymore. Right, thankfully not anymore, I don't know. And also another area, which the name just escaped me. But it was actually a lot of fun. Very, very poor area, but it was definitely good to actually, it was completely disconnected. So I didn't have access to, I could have had access to email by back in Huayapan, where we stayed overnight, but it would have been difficult. And cell phone access was like nothing. But it was good to be disconnected.
Yeah, 3G coverage was a little thin.
Well, actually, 3G coverage was non-existent at that area.
Right.
Yeah, but it was very good because it's been a long time since I've been disconnected. And it's very good, actually. I definitely recommend it.
No, sounds great. Sounds great, Arthur. It sounds like a very good trip.
Yeah, it was good. All right, and so today we have some absolutely awesome, spectacular topics that some that Dennis submitted and wanted to talk about. And I think only one actually comes from me, because like I'm a person who doesn't get excited very easily about new things. And so a lot of the stuff that other people find, I'm like, oh cool, that's fine. Yeah, okay. You know, but really it might be actually quite interesting. Now this browser security test that Dennis submitted, it's something that you just stumbled across, right? I actually did a test in Google, or actually Chromium, which is the testing version, because there's no release version for Mac yet. I decided I'd just try it out. I kind of do that kind of stuff. And I did a test on Chromium, and this is build 31427. And it ran through very quickly, and there's absolutely no vulnerabilities. So I don't know, have you ever came across or come across a browser that actually did have any vulnerabilities?
Well, I've only I've tested. I use Chrome sometimes. I'm a pretty dedicated Firefox user, and we'll talk about that more later, maybe. But no, my testing. I think if you keep everything up to date, you're likely to get all green lights here. But it's just a kind of a nice little tool that you can just go there. It's very fast and a good way to kind of check your browser and make sure that everything is up to date. If everything's up to date, you shouldn't see any vulnerabilities. But we do know that one of the primary vectors for infections is out of date or either browsers or browser plugins. And you know, a lot of times it's not the browser, it's the plugins that get attacked. So it's just a kind of a nice quick tool to keep an eye on things. If you know, those of us who are pretty diligent about keeping our browsers updated probably won't see any problem here. But I'm sure that if we go to some client machines and go to this same website, we'll find some people that don't have everything updated.
Yeah, definitely. You're definitely right about that. And so this definitely, I guess, could be useful. In what way would you think this would be a useful tool?
I think it's just if you're you know, at a client and you're doing some work, it's just one little thing to add to your checklist, you know, to kind of just check and make sure that it's a kind of a quick check to make sure everything is up to date.
Right. Okay. So does it actually check all the plugins? Like, I see that it tests the plugins for vulnerabilities, but does it actually test the plugins for the latest versions as well?
You know, I don't know that it does that directly, but if it finds vulnerabilities, that would be a sure sign that it's not the latest version. Yeah. So probably the end result is the same either way. One of the things that, you know, one of the reasons that I'd like Firefox is that Firefox now routinely checks at least some of the major plugins like Flash to make sure that they're up to date and warns you if they're not, because that has been one of the, and I think will continue to be one of the major attack vectors over the coming months is browser plugins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
People just don't tend to update those as diligently as they do some of their other applications. I mean, people who are security aware are pretty good about keeping up with their operating system updates, but some of the other applications, not as much.
Yeah, exactly, because you have to be very purposeful and just keeping track of when new versions are released, because you don't necessarily know that a new version of Flash got released unless you're keeping up to date with news from Adobe, right? So it just any person will be, it'll be very difficult to keep their plugins up to date.
Right. Well, and you know, one of the tools that I didn't send a link for this, but one of the tools that we've covered in the past that's really useful for that is Secunia PSI.
Okay.
You know, it comes in a couple of different versions, but the PSI version is Personal Software Inspector. It's free, and you can install it on your system, and it does periodic checks, and it looks at basically. It has a huge repository of programs that it knows about, and it's great because it not only warns you about tools or programs that are out of date that have security vulnerabilities, but it gives you a direct link to the download to fix them, and it just does periodic scans. So it's a very, very useful tool.
Okay.
I run it on all of my. I'm not sure if there's a. I think it's pretty much a Windows centric.
Yeah.
But I run it on all my Windows machines and just run that periodically to see what's. And it always finds something that's a little bit out of date. And sometimes it's good just for keeping updates on the latest programs, you know, even if they're not things that are so much subject to security vulnerabilities, but just a really useful tool.
Yeah, no doubt. It definitely looks like it could be useful. So it's even something that we could run on clients' machines and stuff like that as well.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Good stuff. All right. Another topic from Dennis. A year later, I'll look back at Mikolo. Mikolo was a data center, as Dennis explained a little while ago, that was being used for spam and botnets and all kinds of illegal activity. And at the bottom here, there's a graph of the spam drop once that data center was shut down. So I don't know, Dennis, do you want to explain something here?
Yeah, that's worldwide spam. This was a company that rented an entire cage at a data center in, I believe it was San Jose, California. And they were quite intentionally just offering up space to spammers. Because, you know, at this point, if you are a operator of a botnet, if you run a command and control structure, or a spammer, you need a pretty stable, solid environment. You know, this is mature to the point where people are not running these out of their basement at this point. They want, you know, they're using, you know, tier one data centers to host their servers because they need that kind of stability in their environment. Mm-hmm. And this is a group of people they went in and rented not just a couple racks, but an entire cage in a data center, and they basically went about making a lot of money by offering up space to hosting space for spammers and for botnet command and control servers and so on. And so what happened was some security researchers through their work had sort of pinpointed this as a nexus for this kind of activity and went to the ISP and said, you know, these people are doing this and you need to shut them down, or, you know, and there's no way to really force that. But they said, if you don't do something about it, we'll make it a public issue. Right. And the ISP decided that it was in their best interest to shut these people down. And you can see on that graph, the day they shut down, there was like a 60% drop worldwide mm-hmm. in the amount of spam. And it took about 5 months for that to build up again. So, you know, I brought this up because, you know, we have to fight these things on every front possible. And I think that from the standpoint of trying to control this, I think this is maybe one of the better methods, is for, you know, researchers to try to pinpoint these data centers, because they typically tend to be a bit focused, because, you know, most data center operators don't want this kind of activity, and when they see it, they get rid of it. But there are some people who actually make this their business model. Yeah. They provide these hosted servers for these people, and pinpointing them and shutting them down is just one more way to try to battle the spam. And this actually had a significant effect even on not just spam, but also some of the botnet activity. Mm-hmm. So it's just one more way to fight the fight.
Yeah, no doubt. Take it to the source, right? And kill right. the root. Yep. Definitely the best way to kill it. All right, good stuff. Now, this one I find very interesting, Dennis. Firefox, most vulnerable browser. Safari, close second. Sensic released its report revealing the most prominent types of web application vulnerabilities for the first half of 2009. The report details the steady rise of attacks targeting these exploits, ultimately costing the U.S. a substantial amount of money in both IT damage and identity theft. So if you read that, it almost looks like Firefox is the cause of all these problems, all this identity theft, all this substantial amount of money in IT damage. That almost, if you just read it and you have no idea what they're, like, the background behind it, that's the idea you'd get from this.
Yeah, the article points up two things. One is one that we kind of bang on almost every week here, which is that the attacks have shifted. The primary target right now is web vulnerabilities, both on the client side and on the server side. In particular, on the server side, you know, we've seen a number of examples in recent months. The New York Times site had a big problem a couple of months ago, where the problem wasn't on their site, but their banner ads, of course, are served from other URLs. And you know, we know that when we go to particularly to some of these major portal sites where they're drawing a lot of information, a lot of banner ads, they may be pulling information in from 10 or 15 or 20 other websites. And so you think that you're loading a page from a particular source, but you're actually loading web pages from many, many different sources. And in this case, someone had managed to get a malicious ad onto the New York Times site, a banner ad, and it was looking for, as we discussed earlier, unpatched browser plugins. In this case, it was a Flash vulnerability, and if you went to that page and you had a Flash vulnerability, you were infected, and it was just that quick. It immediately infected your system. And so these are the most prominent kinds of attacks these days. You know, the operating systems have become a bit more secure. Windows patching has become a lot more mature, and so you know, there's been a kind of a shift. And so, you know, it shows that the major shift has been toward these web vulnerabilities. So, you know, what that means to us is that we need to probably mature our services as far as providing application scanning, vulnerability scanning, and web vulnerability scanning for our clients and for our hosted clients. And then the other part of that is attacks against the browsers themselves. And browsers are fairly complex programs, and they interact with a lot of different technologies. And it's true that if you look at this, you would get the impression that Firefox is perhaps more vulnerable than other browsers. I have an opinion on that because, I'm a dedicated Firefox user, partly because of the plugins that are available. You have a lot of flexibility. You have a lot of options as far as how you operate your browser and the security of it when you use Firefox. And I think that, and we discussed this earlier, Arthur, that, you know, the Firefox people, I think, are much more diligent about rooting this stuff out, and they are, in fact, patching a lot of vulnerabilities that exist in other browsers as well, because a lot of these browsers use libraries that have been around for a long time, were not really written with security as the main focus. There's a lot of legacy code being used on the internet that goes back quite a few years. And when Firefox goes in and finds a vulnerability and patches it in a library, they're in effect patching vulnerabilities that may exist in other browsers as well. I think that's a little bit misleading. That I think that the reason you see more vulnerabilities on the Firefox side is because I think the Firefox team is a little bit more diligent about digging through the code and rooting this stuff out.
Yeah, definitely. And in fact, I think we all, like everyone on the internet, owe the Mozilla team a lot for how far the internet has come. If it wasn't for them, the internet would definitely not be what it is today. And they're definitely very diligent in working with other third parties. Like, for example, with Firefox 3.5, they added OGG video decoding so that you can play video without the need for any plugins, right? And in fact, there's actually a GreaseMonkey user script that will cause all the YouTube videos to play with this new HTML5, so it won't require Flash to play those videos. So that's actually quite useful, especially because all the CPU usage that you get with Flash these days, and security vulnerabilities and all kinds of stuff. But I definitely think that this article is a little bit misguided. I think they set that title just to draw attention to their website, but it's definitely a good point that the web is the central point of exploitation these days, right? That's where everybody is, and it's the easiest target, right? So everyone's going for it.
Well, yeah, and you know, the problem, of course, is that the browser model was not developed with security in mind. It wasn't really something that people had a reason to think about back in the early days of Netscape. Was one of the pioneers of developing some of these technologies, and so it's, you know, I think at this point, we really need to kind of rein in JavaScript. I mean, you know, for people who listen to Security Now, there was a lot of discussion this last week about JavaScript and, you know, how vulnerable it is. And the fact is, when you go to a web page, you have a technology that is allowed to run basically anything it wants on your computer. And so, I think we just need to mature that model and you know, JavaScript's going to be with us for a long time in some form or another, because it's what makes the web so interactive and so useful to us.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, now we have another topic from the man, Dennis. 10 common identity theft myths dispelled.
Okay. It's, we can kind of parse through these a bit, but... this is just, you know, identity theft has become such a huge issue, and it's such a misunderstood issue, because people really don't, have good information sometimes about what they can do. And people are just kind of, you know, befuddled as to how to protect themselves. Mm-hmm.
The myth number one: there's no way to protect yourself from identity theft. And then the next line says identity theft is preventable.
Yeah, and you know, there are certain things that we do, and the primary thing is just being a little bit cautious. It's a shame we have to be that way in this world, that we have to be, you know, cautious about what we say to people, what information we give out, but we just have to always be a little bit on guard, because people who seem friendly and well intentioned sometimes are actually not so. Number two was an interesting point, I thought, is that people always think about identity theft in terms of being a financial issue, but it is, in fact, sometimes there are other things. It talks here a little bit about, you know, people sometimes will steal health information, not so much to get money from you, but maybe to commit insurance fraud, or to, for other purposes. And so that was an interesting point that I hadn't thought about much in terms of, I always tend to think of identity theft in terms of the financial implications.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely a good point. It's my bank's fault if I become a victim of identity theft. Not so much.
Yeah, you know, there's a widely held misconception that banks will refund the money if money is taken from you, and in many cases, you know, they won't. I mean, they may at best bring you up to a zero balance if you've gone onto the negative side. Yeah. But you know, a lot of times, you know, if it's something that's been a breach on their end, they will certainly be responsible. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you get a virus infection on your machine, or if you are pulled in by a phishing scheme and your bank account gets emptied, your bank will not necessarily, you know, stand behind you and refund that money. Yeah. In fact, in many cases, will not.
Yeah. It is safe to give your personal information over the phone if your caller ID confirms that it is your bank.
Yeah, people sometimes think that caller ID is a reliable control, and in fact, it's easily spoofed. Exactly. There are websites you can go to and make a phone call from the website and put the caller ID in as anything that you mm-hmm. want. So I always tell people, never ever give information of any sensitive nature at all to someone who calls you on the phone. You know, because you don't know who they are, who they're calling from, and some people are very, very good at convincing you. You know, and particularly if they've done a little bit of research, and have a little bit of information about you, they can really make it seem as though they are someone other than who they really are.
Yeah,
so
no doubt.
I always tell people, you know, if you really feel like you need to give out the information, call people back, and don't call them back at the number that they give you. Look up the number. Look up the in a public directory of the bank or whatever institution, and verify that, because the caller ID is no assurance whatsoever of who's calling.
Yeah, no doubt. Like even with Skype, you can spoof it. If you have a call out or a Skype out,
mm-hmm. right.
you can
right.
call anyone and just type in your cell phone number or whatever number you want, and it'll come from that number, right? So. All right, so myth number 5, checking your credit report periodically or using a credit monitoring service is all you need to do to protect yourself from identity theft.
Yeah, it's, credit monitoring is one tool, but it's probably oversold as being protection against identity yeah. theft, and particularly by the companies who offer that service. You know, they really... they offer you that service, and they lead you to believe that is the best way to protect yourself against identity theft. And it's a good thing to do, but it's not the answer in and of itself.
Mm. Yeah, so there's quite a few here. Shredding my mail and other personal documents will keep me safe.
Yeah, and again, it's a good thing to do. The easiest low-tech attack for people who try to steal identities is it's not even illegal in a lot of places to go through people's garbage.
Yeah.
And, people are prone to just kind of get lazy and just kind of throw stuff in the trash.
Right.
So it's good. I tell people what I do is I try to keep a paper shredder either at the desk where I open my mail or process my mail, or right next to the trash can. So that it's not any more difficult to put it in the shredder than it is to throw it in the trash can. And at least in our area, you can recycle shredded paper just as easily as you can recycle paper that's not been shredded. In fact, our recyclers that we have, the recycle center we go to, has a specific bin for shredded paper. Mm-hmm. So it's just one of those things that we have to develop as a habit and be a little bit cautious about what we throw into the trash.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, no. I actually have a separate box that I keep just for important stuff, but shouldn't tell you that. Social networking is safe, right?
Well, social networking has become part of the fabric of our lives, and it's not going to go anywhere. You just have to try to convince people to think about what you divulge and how you divulge it, in that context. Yeah, social networking is a wonderful thing to be able to, it's brought us a lot more contact with a lot more people. It's allowed us to have you know, somewhat intimate contact, or intimate in a sense, with people that we're not physically close to. You know, it's a way for people to maintain friendships over time, but it's also a big target for people who are looking for information to try to steal identities. So we have to be just cautious and careful. You know, we all know that, you know, we advise young people to be, you know, really give a second thought to, you know, what you put on your Facebook page, because, you know, it's several years down the line when you're looking for a job, it may still be there and your employers are going to be looking at your Facebook page. So, you know, it's all the way around. We have to kind of get used to the notion of privacy being part of our social networking and think about it. So I think, you know, social networking is, it's a risk, and it's a risk that most people, particularly younger people, are going to continue to take. So we just have to kind of, you know, urge some moderation there.
No doubt. I think the problem is too many people live for today. And that's not always the best.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I agree.
Kindle 4 PC beta is now available for Windows 7, Vista, and XP. Mac version coming soon. So for those with a Kindle, there you go. I don't have one. I don't think they're going to be available in Canada for quite a while yet. But
yeah, well, and you know, I think that the Kindle service, you know, we'll see how this ports over to the PC. It's still in beta, yeah. So it's yet to be seen. I think the Kindle service is, you know, kind of a nice tool. I mean, it's nice to be able to carry a large number of books around with you in a netbook. You know, one of the things I'm not sure about is how easy it will be to read over a long period of time on a backlit screen. Yeah. One of the I don't own a Kindle, but I know a couple people do, and I've done some reading on the Kindle, it's easier on the eye to use that screen because it's reflected light. Mm-hmm. So you know, I'm not sure how easy it will be to do reading over a long period of time on a netbook screen, but we'll see. But at least it's nice that the service will be available without having to buy that extra device, because a lot of people, you know, find that to be a pretty pricey investment to buy the Kindle
right.
or the Amazon. I'm not sure what the people were thinking at Amazon when they named it the Nook E, but I guess
the Nook E,
you know. That's the Nook E, I guess that's the name that they're going to stick with. But so the good thing is there's some more competition coming in ebook readers, and so that will help keep the prices down, because I think it's a really cool thing to be able to have so much reading material available with you in such a small package.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a free program as well, so a free application. So if you want to, try it out. All right, and another thing that we're just going to mention is the Droid. So for those listening to this recording, we'll hear the sound in the background on the Verizon Wireless Droid website. It's interesting how they're marketing this phone, because if you think about it, the iPhone is almost marketed in a totally different way than the Droid is. The Droid is almost marketed towards the male audience, because the iPhone is almost, see, like most people that I know think, oh, the iPhone, that's a girly phone. I'm not saying anything by that, but it almost seems that way.
Yeah, and you know, the other interesting thing is that the Droid marketing to date has been aimed almost entirely at prying away iPhone users. I mean, every Droid ad that I've seen is very much pointed, you know, directed toward, hey, we're the Droid does basically what the iPhone doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, and I've read some of the reviews. The reviews have been mostly very positive. It's competition is always good. This is probably not an iPhone killer, but it's probably the closest thing so far. The reviews that I've seen indicate that the biggest issue seems to be with the keyboard, is it doesn't, yeah. you know, the keyboard isn't quite what people would like it to be. But then again, it is a real keyboard, and you know, there seems to be kind of two schools of thoughts on virtual keyboards. Some people love them, and some people hate them. You know, it's You know, I know lots of people who say, oh, once I got used to it, I could type much more quickly on that virtual keyboard on the iPhone than I can on a physical keyboard. But then I know other people who just, you know, that so there's something about the tactile feel of a physical keyboard that they just find
it all depends on
more appealing.
How you are training yourself and how you're thinking when you're typing, I guess, right? But yeah, honestly, I wouldn't mind having an Android phone. Like, I have an iPhone right now, but just being able to test it out. Like, I know the previous version of the Android, it would be useless to me because the IMAP mail implementation absolutely sucked. But maybe they improved it in version 2. I definitely hope so.
Well, I've seen Arthur whip through that keyboard on his iPhone, and he's pretty fast. So
yeah, I don't mind the virtual keyboard at all. But the only thing is, when you're driving, it's more difficult to type. But that shouldn't be an issue anyway, because we're not supposed to be typing when we're driving.
Yeah, because who would ever be typing on a keyboard while they're driving?
So it's really a moot point.
Right. So anyway, it's interesting that the iPhone has set a target, and people are definitely taking aim at it. And this is one step forward. And you know, I think in the end, the Android operating system will provide some really serious competition for the iPhone, because they're going to attract the same quality of development. I think the whole reason the iPhone has remained at the top of the pile has been the applications. I mean, it's the application store. And I think, once there's enough momentum and enough of critical mass on the Android side, you'll get people who will start, really developing for Android in the same way. And I think, competition is always good. And, and certainly it's interesting because Verizon has taken dead aim at both the iPhone and AT&T in a very aggressive way. So competition is always a good thing.
And am I right that the Verizon has a much better network than AT&T in the United States?
In the U.S. they have much, much better 3G. I mean, their 3G coverage is much better. They have the best 3G coverage in the U.S. And in fact, AT&T's 3G coverage, their HSPA, yeah, high speed pack, yeah. Their network is by all accounts pitiful. I'm not an AT&T customer, and in fact, I've been really wanting someone else other than AT&T to get the iPhone, but now maybe I don't want the iPhone. Maybe I want the Droid. I'll have to take a look at it. My contract is expiring in a couple of months, and I'm definitely going to be in the market, so I'm definitely going to take a good look at that Droid, because I personally, and this is all opinions are personal opinions and not those of Nerds on Site or anyone's affiliates, but I really just find AT&T to be their coverage is so bad, and I had them at one time, and I will not go back to AT&T as a customer.
Right.
So
yeah,
I'm looking forward to some other alternatives. Mm.
And in fact, they've had to redo a lot of their infrastructure because of the iPhone, right? So,
yeah, and you know, the thing is with Verizon, every Verizon tower is a 3G tower. With AT&T, many of their towers are not 3G towers. So they have AT&T has good phone coverage, but their high speed coverage is not nearly as good as Verizon's.
All right. Now, one other thing that I was just going to mention is Google has released a new programming language. And, you know, honestly, I was expecting to hear from all kinds of people, oh, another programming language, what are we going to do with another programming language, right? But that hasn't been the sound that I've been hearing at all. In fact, most things that I've been hearing about it are, yeah, there's definitely room for another programming language. We already have 1.5 million, but hey, we can definitely use another one. Interesting thing, basically I'll just read from the first paragraph on their open source blog. We believe programming should be fast, productive, and most importantly, fun. That's why we're excited to open source an experimental new language called Go. Go combines the development speed of working in a dynamic language like Python with the performance and safety of a compiled language like C or C++. And I've seen some videos of them working with it. Compiling is amazingly fast. It's designed nicely. It just needs to be put through the test, right? Beaten up a little bit, kneaded down or something, I don't know.
Yeah, so it is a compiled language.
Yep. It's a compiled language, but has the features of a dynamic language. So,
and is it you know structurally similar to like Perl or Python?
Structurally similar to Python and C++. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you look at this line, this little chunk right here, that looks very similar to Python, but it doesn't quite look like Python because the functions are more like C, right? But this part here is like Python. So they've taken a lot of things and put them together. But one of the interesting things that they've done is most programming languages use threads. Python, C, Objective-C, everything uses threads. But they've just thrown that out and... Now they've gone with something called Go routines. So you can have thousands of Go routines and say goodbye to Stack Overflows, is what they say here, right? So
well, that would be interesting. I mean, because as we know, Stack Overflows are still the primary means of breaking code.
Exactly.
I mean, it's you know, most security vulnerabilities in the code do result from Stack Overflows. Like, there are certainly other kinds of attacks,
right,
but that's by far the most commonly used one. So that would be interesting to do that. I have to see how that works.
Yeah. And like a dynamic language, it's memory safe and type safe.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it'll be interesting. Like, I don't know what we use it for, like, except for basic scripting right now, but or designing some kind of program. I don't know, but it's definitely interesting to see where.
Well, if it's something that if it's close enough to C that we could, because you know, C and its derivatives are probably the biggest source of code vulnerabilities,
right,
just because you know the language goes back to a day when people didn't think about you know type and memory safe weren't really concepts at that time, because you know people were trying to make code that
exactly.
worked. People weren't trying to break code.
Yeah. Code that was that worked was, and was as small as work. Possible, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so that you know there wasn't really a lot of thought put into how do we prevent someone with malicious intent from coming in and breaking the code and overflowing the stack and injecting a pointer to some other malicious code. That just wasn't part of the thought
right.
process.
Right.
And there's just such a huge amount of you know legacy code that's written in C and its derivatives, you know, in the libraries. And so if we could find something that would you know make it easy to port some of that stuff over, that would be a huge development.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it would definitely be interesting to see where that goes for sure. And there's a 1 hour tech talk if you want to watch it on YouTube. So I haven't watched it.
Yeah, I'm not really a coder, but from a security perspective, you know, I'm always you know interested in any technology that can help us make safer code, and particularly you know alleviate some of the buffer overflows.
Yep, definitely. So we'll
for then. So
we'll see where that goes. And Dennis has a Google Wave account, so we actually have a Nerdcast Wave here, if anyone wants to join it. My Google Wave ID is arturo@googlewave.com, as you can see right here. And yeah, I think a lot of people have been playing around with it, but played around with it for like a few days and then stopped using it. Yeah, we'll see how it progresses in the future, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we already mentioned the Secunia personal PSI. Yeah, we already mentioned that before. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and one thing that Jeff actually mentioned in the nerdsonsite.tv chat is we talked about the Secunia PSI software for Mac There's an app update widget, which I'll see if I can bring up over here. And so I believe that it's a dashboard widget that does the same thing. I think we've talked about this before, but if you're on a Mac, this is kind of equivalent to that. So there you go.
Oh, cool. I didn't realize it had been that it was the Mac version.
Well, it's not from Secunia, but it's the same functionality, right? So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, we all want to keep our Mac programs updated, but from a security perspective, it's just not quite as big of a deal as it is on the Windows side.
Okay. Well, that concludes Nerdcast episode 30. And we had an amazing episode with Dennis from West Virginia. And our Nerdcast Studio 1 computer, which is a streaming computer. And it just didn't say anything. It was very quiet today. And myself, Arthur Weeb from London, Ontario, or wherever I happened to be at the time. So thank you, everyone, for joining. And have a productive day, night, morning, whatever happens to be for you.
All right. As always, Arthur, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Have a good week.
Thanks, Dennis. Goodbye.
A nerd. It's great to be a nerd. We know the truth is out there, but we'd have to leave our room. We are the nerds in your neighborhood. Polyester's a fashion statement, but there's more room on the beach for you, 'cause we're locked in our basement. It's great to be a nerd. It's great to be a nerd. We like to wear colors that do not appear in nature. It's great to be a poorly dressed, fashionless, dirt tricking, role-playing, 90-pound, one-without, pasty skin, puckered, underfed genius. Yes, it's great to be.